partial results from Iran's presidential election puts Ibrahim Raisi well ahead of other candidates with more than 60% of the votes. The Yemeni army launches a drone attack on Saudi Arabia's King Khalid military base near the city of Khamis Mashayekh. Also coming up, the U.S. says it is reducing the number of troops, aircraft, and anti-missile systems in the West Asia region. We'll start this bulletin with the latest updates on Iran's presidential election. Frontrunner in Iran's presidential election, Ibrahim Raisi, has been congratulated by other candidates for winning Friday's vote. Mohsen Rezaei, Abdel Nasser Hemeti, and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi sent congratulatory messages to Raisi as partial results put him well ahead of his rivals. Rezaei said the June 18th vote has once again proven the efforts of the Iranian nation protecting and strengthening the security and power of the country. Hemeti expressed hope that the new administration would bring comfort and prosperity to the nation. Ghazizadeh Hashemi appreciated what he called the massive and glorious turnout of vigilant and loyal people of the country. Iran's current president Hassan Rouhani also met with Raisi and congratulated him. He also expressed gratitude for people's participation, precision, and punctuality in the 13th presidential election. Political commentator Said Hosseini says a government backed by the popular vote will have a strong position while negotiating with other countries.
It's more a celebration than election in Iran. Celebration of democracy, celebration of the wish and the will of people, which prevails at the end, and also celebration of their victory against all of the odds, the double standard of the entire world when it comes to the democracy. Some of these Western countries, they don't want to admit about the existence of democracy in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think the Iranian nation has realized this double standard, and in spite of all of the problems that they have inside, from economical point of view, from sanction point of view, you can see that the different forks of life, teachers, students, clergies, the traders, every single person who is loving their nation and who love their progress and their democracy have been participating. A government which is backed by the vote of people have an upper hand when they do negotiation.
Political commentator Masoud Shajara says that opponents of the Islamic Republic are intimidating Iranians abroad to stop them from voting.
There is a double standard and a hypocrisy going on. You're seeing people who are opponents of Islamic Republic, and as a matter of fact, there are supporters of either being promoted by the Saudis or by the Americans or by other powers who see themselves an opponent of the Islamic Republic. These guys are they say that there is no democracy in Iran, and then at the same time they're trying to stop people actually going and voting, and they're intimidating them, they're bullying them. We've seen it in London and elsewhere. People are being really intimidated in a very vicious way to stop them voting, and then at the same time they actually complain that they say that the system in Iran, the government hasn't got support. So really they're trying to create a news and then sort of promote it and to undermine the will of the people.
Okay, we're now going to pass on over to our other studios. Omid has been diligently been giving us the updates and all the news stories regarding Iran's presidential election, the 13th one, of which there's some results that have come in. And Omid, it's been how many days since you've been doing this, and great job on that. And of course, today is the cream of the top, as they say, where the results have come in. Fill us in on what's happened.
You're right. It's been, I guess, 32, 33 days that we've been covering Iran's 13th presidential election. And as you said, Iran has announced partial results from the June 18 presidential election. And again, as you said, this is the cream on the top. According to the head of the Interior Ministry's Election Commission, Jamal Orp, 28,600,000 votes have been counted so far. Ebrahim Raisi is leading with more than 17,800,000 votes. He has held a number of key posts since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Raisi has promised to fight corruption and uproot poverty. Mohsen Rezaei is ranked second with over 3,300,000 votes. He is the secretary of the Expediency Council. His campaign slogan was an overhaul in the country's governance and economy. He also pledged to increase cash subsidies by tenfold. Abdul Nasser Hemmati managed to garner 2.4 million votes and is in the third place. He was the governor of Central Bank of Iran from 2008 until 2021. He had vowed to tackle economic problems such as inflation, unemployment, and housing. And last, Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi has garnered nearly 1 million votes. He has represented the electoral district of Mashhad and Kalat in the legislature chamber since 2008. During his campaign, he had promised to create 4 million jobs and bring the inflation to below 5%. The Interior Ministry says the final results will be announced later on Saturday. Over 59.3 million Iranians were eligible to cast their ballots in Iran's 13th presidential election. Polls opened at 7 a.m. local time and closed at 2 a.m. local time the following day after 19 hours of voting nationwide and at Iranian missions abroad. Polling was extended several times to accommodate incoming voters. Health protocols amid the COVID-19 pandemic were observed during the electoral process. Nearly 67,000 polling stations were set up across the country. Officials say the number of voting places increased to alleviate concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. There were also 450 polling stations at Iranian embassies and missions worldwide. Now let's take a look at the front runner's background and what plans he has outlined during his election campaign. Ebrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric. He has held several key posts in the judiciary branch since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He was the prosecutor of the cities of Karaj, Hamadan, as well as the capital of Tehran. Raisi also served as first deputy chief of justice of Iran and the attorney general of the country. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astan Quds Razavi, and in 2019, he was appointed as the judiciary chief, a post he currently serves. The prominent cleric is leading with a wide margin, as I just said, in the Iranian presidential race. He is running on a platform of tackling economic problems such as poverty, unemployment, and inflation. Let's take a listen.
My administration will have no red line in fighting corruption. The root cause of injustices in the executive branch of the government must be dried up. The banking, tax, import, and export systems must be reformed.
The country's economy, Raisi says the current conditions are quote-unquote unacceptable since people are not able to predict their financial situation due to constant fluctuations. He has unveiled a plan on economic recovery. Let's take a listen.
My economic plan can be summed up in three main points. Of course, there are other important issues I will address later if time allows. But now I would like to mention these three principles, which are the most important ones. The first one is overhauling governance and fighting corruption, inefficiency, and discrimination. The second point concerns supporting underprivileged families and social strata. And the third is increasing production and boosting businesses.
Regarding the 2015 nuclear deal, Raisi says he has set an agenda for securing the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. He has highlighted the need for strengthening Iran's economy in the face of sanctions or any other trauma that might afflict the country's economy.
The Iranian nation should do all in its power to confront those who seek to breach the Iranian nation's rights and pursue the removal of sanctions. Definitely, action should be taken to bring about the removal of the sanctions.
On foreign policy, Raisi has vowed to expand ties with countries across the globe, but says Iran's neighbors should be prioritized in foreign relations. Take a listen.
With your help and through strong diplomacy, we can establish good relations with the regional countries and raise the volume of our exports to the neighbors to the best level. We believe in interactions with the entire world in order to solve the country's economic issues, but the regional countries should be a priority.
Well, Kaveh, that's it for now. Back to you.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out an airstrike on an airbase inside of Saudi Arabia. The army spokesman Yahya Sari says that a Qassam 2K drone targeted the King Khalid base near the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis Mashayat. Sari says the operation was successful, with the target being hit precisely. According to Sari, the attack was in response to Saudi Arabia's military aggression and continued siege of Yemen. The Saudi-led military coalition launched a war in Yemen in 2015, with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. They've been pushing for the lifting of the blockade on Yemen and an end to the war that has killed tens of thousands of people. Yemenis have held a symposium in the capital city of Sana'a to discuss the decades-long Israeli aggression against the Palestinians. The symposium is aimed at raising awareness on the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif Al-Moshali has more.
Jerusalem is closer than ever is the slogan of a symposium held in Yemeni capital Sana'a to discuss the Israel's long-lasting atrocities against the Palestinian nation. The organizers say the recent 11-day war has proved that the third generation of Palestinians is more capable of standing against Israel. They say the resistance has got stronger despite the normalization efforts of some Arab states.
The axis of resistance was able to prove its existence despite all the conspiracies of the closest people. There are Arab countries that are considered close to the Palestinian resistance, but unfortunately, they continue to stab the resistance through normalization with the Zionist entity. And these countries are the ones who seek to weaken and bring down the resistance. Today, the third generation of the Palestinians is capable more than ever of defending Palestine against Israel's aggression.
The gathering also hailed the support of allies for Palestinian cause, including Iran, who they say has always backed the Palestinian nation overtly. The participants said Iran has played a key role in changing the balance of the war between Palestine and the Israeli regime.
Since the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran 4 years ago, it has made Palestine its main issue, as Imam Khomeini declared that Iran's independence will not be complete without the liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian cause is at the heart of Iran's political strategy, and despite the conspiracies that Iran has gone through, it still supports the Palestinian resistance and has been a key factor in changing the equation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
The Palestinian cause is also an issue of consideration for several other Islamic states, including Yemen. Last month, Yemenis launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance groups, even though they are going through a tragic humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
People here believe that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They say the recent victory proved that the Palestinian nation is on the right path to regain its rights. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have injured at least 56 Palestinians in separate attacks in the occupied territories.
Three
9 Palestinian protesters were wounded after Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Regime forces fired rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades. Israeli forces also arrested at least 10 demonstrators. The Palestinians were protesting against Tuesday's flag march by Israeli settlers in Al-Quds. During the parade, the settlers, escorted by army forces, chanted insulting slogans against the Prophet Muhammad while shouting death to Arabs. Also on Friday, at least 47 Palestinians were injured by Israeli troops near the West Bank town of Beitta. The Palestinians were demonstrating against a new settlement outpost there. Mona Kandil says that Israel is using excessive force to stop Palestinians from taking part in demonstrations while backing Israeli settlers to steal more land and to build illegal settlements.
Palestinian experts and human rights organizations say that Israeli forces are using excessive force in order to terrify the Palestinian villagers and the protesters in order not to take place in the, to take part in these demonstrations and protests. At the same time, they continue to protect the Israeli settlers to steal and to seize more lands and annex them to illegal settlements, or even to steal these lands and build illegal settlements.
The U.S. Defense Department says Washington has started to cut the number of its anti-missile systems in the West Asia region. The Pentagon says it is pulling one THAAD and 8 Patriot missile systems, along with hundreds of troops supporting them from the region. The U.S. is also reducing jet fighter squadrons assigned to West Asia as part of the withdrawal process that started on June 2nd. The military hardware is being pulled mainly from Saudi Arabia, but also from Kuwait and from Iraq. The administration of President Joe Biden has pledged to reduce the U.S. military presence in the region to focus on what it calls threats from China and Russia. However, Washington is expected to maintain a substantial military presence, including thousands of troops in the region, especially in Iraq and in Syria. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The limelight. Today, the threat to the democracies in the West and elsewhere is from within. The crisis of Western democracies is purely internal and not a product of Russia or China. We now present you an article written by Bim Bertel, visiting faculty for a Master's in International Relations and Diplomacy at Tripuvan University in Kathmandu, Nepal. The piece is titled Biden's Call for Democratic Values, Alliance is Hollow Rhetoric. U.S. President Joe Biden is wrapping up his first foreign trip to Europe as President of the United States to reclaim the so-called global leadership role that his predecessor, Donald Trump, abandoned after taking office in January of 2017. Joe Biden tried to renew relations with European NATO members and with other allies. To reclaim his country's so-called vanguard role, Joe Biden used the slogan, "The United States is back." During the trip, in most of his speeches, Joe Biden claimed that cooperation and partnership among the Group of Seven and other invitees to last weekend's G7 summit, such as Australia, India, Japan, and South Africa, as well as other U.S. allies, are based on specific values. Biden claimed that the United States' alliances and partnerships are based on human rights and democratic values. However, he also emphasized that these values are under severe threat from foreign powers. He reiterated that such threats are coming from Vladimir Putin of Russia and Xi Jinping of China. Joe Biden's claim is not new. It is a continuation of Donald Trump's foreign policy. The slight difference is that Trump was perceived as soft on Russia and tough on China. Biden wanted to give an impression that he's taking a tough stance against Russia as well. To keep American public opinion favorable towards him, Joe Biden's high-level diplomatic acts may be helpful to him domestically, but there was a lot of noise and pomp and very little substance. Biden is doing precisely what a right-wing populist like Donald Trump would do. To avoid taking responsibility for their citizens' well-being, to cover up their grave failures and to distract public attention from their own severe botches, right-wing populists and nationalists use such tactics worldwide. Unfortunately, Joe Biden has continued the same strategy. Biden and his team are well aware that democracy is now on the defensive all over the world, in developed as well as in developing countries. The democratic system of governance is more in crisis than after the Great Depression of the 1930s. Perhaps the Biden team are not unaware that Nazism and fascism sprouted in Germany and Italy as the unintended consequences of Western democracy. Those political systems developed as external threats to the so-called free world across the Atlantic. Today, the threat of the democracies in the West and elsewhere is from within. The crisis of Western democracies is purely internal and not a product of Russia or China. Ultra-nationalists and right-wing populist leaders such as Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson in the United Kingdom, Donald Trump in the United States, and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil have been tampering with democratic norms and democratic values. They are the products of the internal failures of democracy. Biden, in his address on 9th of June to U.S. Air Force personnel and their families stationed at Royal Air Force in Mildenhall, quoting the Declaration of Independence, said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We mean it. No nation can defeat us as long as we stick to our values." However, democracy has failed to ensure the lives, liberties, and pursuits of happiness of the people, not just in the United States, but in other countries too. The post-2008 financial crisis and the current COVID-19 pandemic have both proved that democracies in the West and in the developing world have failed miserably. For instance, democracy in the United States has failed to protect the lives and liberties of women, people of color, and other minorities. American society is deeply divided today. The hashtag MeToo movement and the Black Lives Matter movement depict a severe lack of human rights and democracy for many people living in the United States. Racism, xenophobia, economic inequality, gun violence, and police brutality are long-standing characteristics of the world's oldest democracy. American democracy primarily contributes to protecting the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for the rich and protects the private property of the wealthy. American democracy, as defined by Abraham Lincoln, of the people, by the people, and for the people, has now been converted into of the 1%, by the 1%, and for the 1%, as depicted by Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. The attack on Capitol Hill on 6th of January this year was the internal outcome of the decline of American democracy. The world's so-called oldest democracy, the United States, the purported mother of parliamentary democracy, the United Kingdom, and South America's largest democracy, Brazil, all failed to protect their citizens from the pandemic. None of the leaders of these democracies were held accountable for their failures. Instead, these leaders claimed foreign threats to distract voters from their grave failures. And Joe Biden wants to protect democratic values by way of partnerships and alliances with these very same irresponsible and unaccountable leaders. Every student of political science and government reads in undergraduate textbooks that the most significant merit of a democracy is to be responsible and accountable to its citizens. It is the responsibility of a democratic state to protect its citizens' life, liberty, and property. However, today's democracies are neither accountable to the electorate nor accountable for their grave failures. For example, the world-renowned health science journal The Lancet published 5 articles on the coronavirus outbreak in mid-February of 2020. It warned of its potential public health risks. However, the United States, Brazil, France, and the United Kingdom have some of the highest COVID-19 infection rates per million population. The highest COVID-related death tolls are found in these countries that Joe Biden called like-minded democracies. Do Biden's democratic alliances and partnerships mean collaboration and partnership with the failed, the irresponsible, and the unaccountable? If so, then it looks like democracy has taken the form of an overly worn hat that has lost its shape. If Joe Biden's like-minded democratic partners are Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro, Britain's Boris Johnson, and Australia's Scott Morrison, while Biden himself is following in Donald Trump's footsteps on foreign policy, democracy is an alliance and partnership of irresponsible and unaccountable people. In such a case, democracy is entirely hollow and without foundation.
The debate.
Election day in Iran, people are heading to the polls across the country to choose a new president for the next 4 years. More than 59 million Iranians are eligible to cast ballots. Voters will choose a successor to incumbent president Hassan Rouhani from the 4 candidates running. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called for a high turnout, stressing that a high turnout can help the country gain major advantages at the international level. Incumbent Hassan Rouhani has also called on people from all walks of life to participate in the election. Rouhani said that a high turnout will frustrate Iran's enemies. The Iranian economy and the outcome of the JCPOA negotiations are some of the key issues leading up to the elections. Joining us on tonight's debate,
We have political analyst and university professor Fouad Izadi joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran, also. We have director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Mr. Salmahdi Torabi, joining us also from the Iranian capital. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Mr. Salmahdi Torabi, let's start off with you. Why are these elections so important? What's at stake in today's elections?
Well, as the leader mentioned in his speech a day before or a couple days before the elections, the most important basis of the revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic was the participation of the people. This was not a revolution that was conducted by a, you know, officer corps of the military or the vanguard elite of some party, of some revolutionary party. It was a revolution that was conducted by the people themselves. And the whole establishment, the whole Islamic Republic is based on the participation of the people. I want to point out something, which is that, of course, the most important election today was the presidential election, but it wasn't only a presidential election. Here in Tehran, we had a very interesting ballot. We had three seats in the Assembly of Experts, which is the body that appoints the Supreme Leader. We had a one by-election in the Majlis, which is the legislative body of the country, and we had the local city council elections with 21 members. So, as you can see, the elections work on all levels, from the local level to the legislature to the executive branch, and even higher than that. That's related to the supreme leadership. And on all levels, the destiny of the country is determined by the vote of the people.
Professor Izadi, welcome to the program. Please give us your perspective on the significance of Iran's presidential election.
Well, the election is significant because it's going to have ramifications internally inside the country and internationally. Internationally, we have a number of Western governments headed by the United States that have always tried to demonize Iran and question the legitimacy of Iran's elections. You know, in political science, we have this democratic peace theory, which says that democracies don't have conflicts. And since the United States have been fighting the Iranian people for many, many years, by definition, Iran cannot have a democracy, cannot be a democracy. And if you have millions of people participating in elections, then that needs to be delegitimized, and so the popular backing of the government should not be presented internationally. So the election process or results or the fact that people are coming to the polls needs to not be known to the outside world. And by doing that, they can say that Iran's government doesn't have legitimacy, and that way they can basically justify this economic warfare that they have been conducting against Iranian people. So that's why the election is important. If we have enough international media covering the elections the way they are and presenting the facts about Iran, that's going to make the job of people like Biden more difficult. And that's the basic aim. Internally, there are obviously differences between different candidates. So you had Fahemati, who was saying that he is a technocrat. His domestic policy, economic policy, is very much inspired by the new liberal political and economic thought internationally. And he was going to follow Rouhani's foreign policy as well. In fact, he was probably going to keep Dr. Zarif as the foreign minister. On the other hand, you had someone like Mr. Raisi that comes from this liberation theology background. He's a theologian, he's a cleric, and in line with what the Islamic Republic started with, helping the poor, these type of clerics that follow the revolutionary or political Islam say that we have a responsibility for the poor. So if you paid attention to the debates, you saw that he was talking a lot about the poor and helping the poor, and that's where he comes from. So he's not a technocrat, and he hopefully is going to learn from the experiences of the Rouhani administration for the last 8 years when it comes to foreign policy.
Why are certain countries trying to undermine Iran's elections and its democratic efforts?
Sure. I mean, I think it's clear that when you look at the region and when you look at the way that the governments in the region are constellated, the reason that, for example, you have certain tribal rulers and family rulers in Saudi Arabia, Emirates, etc., existing is because of the support of the Americans. So what they fear the most is a Republican system of government and a system of governance where the people get to decide who's the ruler. If you look at a place like Bahrain, the whole reason you had the revolution in Bahrain, which was violently and suppressed, was because there was a person who had been the prime minister for 41 years who happened to be the uncle of the king, and the Americans and the Saudis insisted that the Saudis insisted that he remain as the prime minister, even though there were parliamentary elections in Bahrain that gave the majority to other parties. But the rulership was not willing to change that because the Americans and the Saudis were not happy about that. So the point is that the reason the enemies of Iran, whether it's the Americans or their local lackeys in the region, don't like the elections in Iran is because it shows their dictatorship. It shows to the world that they are dictators, and it shows to the world that they are racist apartheid states like in Israel. Because if you had an actual election in Israel where you included 48 Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, you would have a majority of Palestinians and non-Zionist Jews if you include the ultra-Orthodox and some of the secular left-wing Jews that live in Israel, and you might not even have a Zionist state. So the biggest danger for America and the local rulers that are its lackeys is when the people get to vote. That's why they've been, doing propaganda against the Islamic Republic and elections in Iran for 42 years, because it shows their own weakness. And of course, the good thing about, the times that we live in is that maybe 40 years ago, with very limited media and very limited information that people had access to, you could have gotten away with lying about what the reality is. But we live in a world where information is transmitted very quickly, where people themselves can take the films and the different information that they can gather and pass it to other people around the world. And it's very clear to everyone now that the only country in the region where there's any sort of meaningful participation of the people is Iran. One could include Turkey also in this, but there are issues with Turkey. If you look at the way, for example, Erdogan has turned it into a pretty much a personal presidential, we don't want to call it a dictatorship, but very, very authoritarian. And previous to that, of course, you had the army ruling in Turkey, whether it was in the background or openly, as they did after the coup in 1980. So the only country in the region where the people matter, where, as I mentioned previously, at every level of governance, beginning from the supreme leadership all the way down to the local level, it is the people who decide who runs the country and what policies are made for the future.
Professor Izadi, why are some Western countries adamant in trying to delegitimize Iran's elections?
Well, because they want to pressure the Iranian people, and by sort of questioning the legitimacy of Iran's election, they can follow and continue that policy. The fact that you have a significant portion of the population, we don't know how many people will show up on today's election, but generally Iran's elections attract more than 50% of the population. That has been, Iran has had 39 elections in the last 42 years, and with the exception of one, all of them attracted more than 50%. We have had cases in some years that the number of participants reached to 75, 80% of the people who eligible to vote. So if people realize internationally that majority of Iranians trust the system of government in Iran, that they go and stand in the polls for sometimes hours to cast the ballot, that shows that the government has legitimacy. And the fact that Iran's government has legitimacy gives it power in international arena. And sanctioning this government is going to be more difficult. So what countries like the United States have to do is to question the legitimacy of the government and ignore the fact that there is this very significant popular support for the government. And interestingly, this is one of the things that people in Iran have realized. So when reporters talk to people who are standing in lines, a lot of times this issue of the fact that they're in lines because they want to send a message to the United States comes up. So what the U.S. is actually doing by interfering in Iran's domestic affairs, it's actually providing a reason for people to go to the polls. People who may not have gone to the polls because of economic difficulties that they have and other issues. You know, this year there was this concern about voter participation because of two main reasons. One was COVID-19, you know, that crowded places when you go and cast the vote, there's a chance you may get sick. So that was one concern, that people would not go out. And the second concern was that the people who voted for President Rouhani 4 years ago and 8 years ago, and are not happy with his performance, and there are very few people in Iran that are happy with his performance, they may not want to vote for the other party, other camp. So they may decide to stay at home because they don't want to vote for Rouhani, they don't want to vote for Rouhani's line, they don't want to vote, for example, for Mr. Hemmati, and they don't want to vote for the other side. And they don't. The reason they don't want to vote for Mr. Hemmati is because they're not happy with the way Rouhani conducted his government. And so there was this concern that people may not come to the polls as much as they did before because of these two reasons. So and you have to wait and see basically how many people will show up.
So, Matthew Torab, you mentioned the issue of voter turnout and the people's presence. Those are comments that were also echoed by Ayatollah Khamenei. Also, many observers, they maintain that a strong voter turnout, it displays national unity against the enemies. The Iranian president, the incumbent president, said that a strong turnout will frustrate the adversaries of the Islamic Republic and can foil plots of Iran's enemies. Unpack that for us.
Sure. I mean, I think most of the issue was discussed by Dr. Izadi, and I don't know if there's any much more I can add to that. The reality is that Iranians need no foreign or outside reason to go to the polls, because we have a 100-year history of people being martyred, executed, tortured for us to have the vote. It started almost more than 100 years ago with the Constitutional Revolution, which then ended up in the Pahlavi dictatorship as installed by the English. Then in the 50s, we had the Mossadegh nationalist government, again overthrown in a coup by the Americans. And then finally, in the late 70s, we had the establishment of the Islamic Republic, which for the first time allowed the Iranian people to have a vote. So for us, having the vote came with a very, very high price. Our grandfathers, our fathers, our great-grandfathers, our grandfathers, our fathers, and mothers and great-grandmothers and grandmothers were, you know, suffered a lot for this. So, yes, of course, as we look at our own history, we understand those who actually know their history know why they have to go vote, whether it's to, you know, live up to that legacy as it relates to the British at the beginning of the 20th century or as it relates to the interferences by the Americans in the late 20th century. And these things didn't change after the revolution. They didn't change. The Americans and their allies, the Europeans, and their local lackeys did not suddenly decide, oh, yes, okay, we accept the fact that the Iranians have decided that they want to have a republic and not have an absolute monarchy for 2,500 years. We accept the fact that the Iranians don't want to live in a semi-feudal country with 30% literacy, which is what it was in the year that I was born, 1972. There was 30% literacy and 70% illiteracy in this country. And you know, anybody who has a brain, anybody whose you know, rational thinking capabilities are not, you know, in some way distorted, can tell the difference between the Iran that we have today and the Iran that existed 42 years ago when the revolution happened. So, yes, of course, those countries whose goal and stated goal for over 100 years is to control West Asia, which is the most important strategic area of the world. West Asia, according to the Westerners, this is not my claim, this is their own analysis that they have been telling the world for over 100 years. The most important strategic area of the world is West Asia. And guess what? The heart of West Asia is Iran. So whoever rules Iran, again, not my analysis, this is what they're saying, whoever rules Iran and West Asia rules the world, because that person, that country or that alliance is able to control the flow of everything from east to west, is capable of shutting down oil and any sort of strategic, you know, whether it's in the air or whether it's in the sea, any sort of strategic and military, you know, going back and forth between north and south, east and west. And so, of course, they are very hurt by the fact that they lost Iran. They had hoped with the Pahlavi regime to have their local, you know, bully here, which they call the local gendarme, to be able to go and kill whoever they want in the region, but not, you know, get their own hands dirty. Something that, for example, the Saudis or the Israelis are now doing more and have taken over. And very recently, unfortunately, the Emiratis, as we see in Yemen. And so when they lost that, they lost, you know, the crown jewel of their West Asian empire or their global empire. And they can't handle it. They can't get over it. Whether the Iranians want to have Dr. Rouhani or Dr. Ahmadinejad or Dr. Khatami or whoever as the president, they don't care. The important thing to them is whoever comes into power is put under pressure, and that somehow in their deranged analysis, they think this is like the Soviet Union or East Europe at the end of the Cold War, where somehow if people are, you know, driven to starvation, they will rise up. First of all, we're not driven to starvation. During the worst sanctions in human history, again, as claimed by themselves, we've had the most significant technological advances. We don't have widespread hunger. We don't have desperation. The only thing we have is we have those countries not wanting to accept that Iran takes its position as the natural hegemon of West Asia, that Iran takes its historic position as one of the leaders of human civilization. As we saw, as the leader pointed out in his speech, in the middle of all the sanctions and all the maximum pressure, we are one of the few countries that has developed not only one, but four or five, I don't even know now, four or five vaccines against COVID, which, you know, sure, inshallah, will be passing out. So again, it's about Iran not being powerful and Iran not taking its historic position as one of the leaders of human civilization, and they can't handle it. And that's why they do what they do for all these years.
Professor Izadi, I'd like to get your thoughts on what Mr. Torabi just mentioned. You know, the United States, at the helm of the Western world, they claim to be advocates of democracy, but looking at their track record in the region, putting the magnifying glass on the region, I know it transcends West Asia, but just focusing on the Middle East, they don't want democracy in the region. As Mr. Torabi pointed out, the 1953 coup in Iran shows that as well. Can you explain that double standards that we're seeing from the United States?
Well, they actually have to explain what they are doing, because they very much like the Shah regime, they like the monarchies in southern states in the Persian Gulf, and they don't like Iran, that has one of the thriving democracies in this region and internationally. So the double standards need to be explained by the other side. The fact that there is a republic now after many centuries of the monarchy system is something that people cherish. So with all the difficulties that people have in Iran, they like the fact that they get the chance to vote. You know, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about this fact that some of these monarchies around the Persian Gulf don't do any elections at all. And they're financing television channels based in London that are encouraging Iranians not to go to the polls. And they are encouraging Iranians not to go to the polls because they claim that Iran's government is not democratic enough. So what Ayatollah Khamenei was saying is that the countries that are paying for these channels don't know the difference between the ballot box and a fruit box because they don't do elections. For these countries to want to undermine Iran's democracy is going to be something very foolish. And for governments like the United States to be supporting these countries and then fighting Iran, that's also very foolish. It hasn't worked. U.S. policy towards Iran in a major failure in the last 42 years. And with people's participation, Iran will maintain its standing and will ensure that the U.S. policies will continue to fail. And the sooner American officials realize the facts about Iran, the sooner they realize that the people of Iran are not going to accept a government like Shah's government, they're not going to do that. They're not going to allow their government to be run by the United States. The sooner they realize that, the better it's going to be for them, because the failed policies of the past has also hurted them at the same time that they have hurted the public in Iran.
And Salman Titorabi, very briefly, if you may, Mr. Izzetti just brought up an interesting point there about the United States criticizing other countries' elections. The Electoral College, that's a mess. The recent presidential elections in the United States, it was chaotic. I don't have the proper words to say what it was. It was a bunch of political shenanigans being played out. The United States is not really in a position to criticize anybody's elections, is it?
Absolutely not. Anybody who's lived in the States like we have knows that, especially in those areas that are controlled by Democrats, we have almost 100 and sometimes longer 100-year history of the mafia and the local mob working with the Democratic Party to vote for whoever they want to do. I don't have the facts to show you that there was fraud, but I am positive that there was fraud in many of those states like Pennsylvania, or Michigan, or Wisconsin, or New York, or New Jersey, or Florida. So these are things that anybody who's lived in America knows. The fact that you don't have the empire media, the boot-licking media of America, you know, talking about these things, well, you know, maybe that's the problem. It's not that the American people don't know, and if you, the polls have been conducted, up to 70% of Republican voters, in some polls it's 50%, do not consider Biden to be a legitimately elected president. You know, I don't want to talk about that maybe that much because, hey, whatever. If the Americans, you know, think that that's a problem, it's their responsibility to have a revolution like we had a revolution.
Okay,
so, inshallah, they will have a revolution.
All right, I'm sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guest, political analyst and university professor Fouad Izzetti, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also thanks to Director Rasulat Strategic Studies Institute, Mr. Salman Titorabi, also speaking to us from the Iranian capital, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's debate. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues that are raised during the Islamic upbringing of our children. To help us with our questions, we have the dear and beloved Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. We are going to have this comprehensive look at a positive upbringing of our children. Sayyid, salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's always nice to have you here. Thanks for giving us your time.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The pleasure is all mine. I'm glad to be here with you.
Thank you. So, Sayyid, on our last episode, we took a general look at what we're trying to do here. We're trying to take a comprehensive approach to the Islamic upbringing of our children. And the key word for this series is positive upbringing. That's what we're trying to do. But generally speaking, what methods are there that we should learn when it comes to raising our children?
All right. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. I would like to begin with something that you said in the last program that we had, which was you said, you know, because the process of upbringing causes parents a lot of stress. Right, so how do we cope with that stress? So before we start with our kids, and I think we've stressed this point like in many, many episodes before, that in order for you to be a better educator, there are a few things you need to keep in mind, right? So that itself will relieve you of the stress, okay? As an educator, as a parent, as someone who wants to educate, you have to keep in mind a few things, right? One is that you are responsible for your kids' upbringing, not the teachers, not the school, not the friends, not the house, not the seminary. You are responsible. First and foremost, he is a trust from Allah given to you, and you have to raise that child, and then you have to have that certainty within you that it is your responsibility, because sometimes when we don't accept responsibility, it causes me and you what? A bit of stress. Like, what should I do? This and that. Because you're not putting yourself in the role. You're not playing or taking the role of teaching or educating or upbringing your child in a very certain manner. As we say, you don't have yaqeen qat'i, that it is your role. It's like, you know what? He will learn. I mean, I'll send him to school, he will learn. I will take